right, welcome everyone. Chair Moeller is in another committee this morning, and we have Representative Vice Chair Feist Bills up first, so I'm going to take the first couple of them. And obviously, I am just getting back into the swing of things of being in the legislature because I was dumb enough to be the first person to respond to a text. So asking if we could do this, which was a massive mistake on my part. But we'll get it, so it's good. So thanks, everybody, for being here. We do have a quorum, and we have the minutes to approve. I forget who we usually do with the minutes. Minutes from February 28, 2023, meeting minutes, Vice Chair Feist.
Yes, I'd be happy to move those minutes.
So we, I lost my place. Representative Feist moves approval of the minutes for February 28, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 And opposed, motion passes. All right, so we have four bills up today, and we, just a note for everybody, we are going until 12:30 today to make up for missing a meeting last week. And so, Vice Chair Feist, we can, would you like to take 1712 first, or would you like to go into that one first? Okay. So as Vice Chair Feist gets ready, the first bill we're hearing today is House File 1712. This is Representative Feist's bill, and we will be laying over House File 1712 before I move to lay over House File 1712. And Vice Chair Feist, you can proceed.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1712 is grants for prevention and intervention for at-risk youth. Detention can have a profound impact on the life outcomes for youth and must be used only in cases where a risk to the child's health and welfare or a public safety risk exists. Research shows that youth who come into contact with the juvenile justice system are more likely to sustain or increase their level of delinquent behavior. Severe sanctions can result in increases in future delinquent or criminal involvement rather than a decline. The justice system is documented as a criminogenic environment whereby youth learn behaviors and attitudes from others who are more criminally sophisticated. Contact with the juvenile justice system is known to interrupt positive social connections for youth. Detention and out-of-home placement specifically can disrupt family connections, schooling, and involvement in positive activities. Certain delinquent acts can affect employment opportunities, rental, housing, and federal food support, college admissions and loan eligibility, careers in law enforcement, human services, education, and healthcare, and military service. Research at the national level shows that youth of color, including indigenous youth, are often overrepresented at stages of the justice system focused on accountability and sanctions, while underrepresented at stages intended to curtail deeper system involvement and provide community-based services. Minnesota shares in this problem with rates of disparity for youth of color in the justice system, which are both higher than national levels and more severe in magnitude than those of many comparable states. This bill seeks to invest dollars where the experts say they can be most impactful for both public safety and reducing the absolutely unacceptable disparities in our juvenile justice system and juvenile out-of-home placement. By funding programs designed to address trauma, provide culturally competent behavioral and mental health interventions, interventions for families struggling with domestic violence, chemical dependency, and poverty, and related programs to support at-risk youth. We can and must do better by our youth in Minnesota, and this bill represents a step in the right direction. And I would encourage members to look at the letters from many of the programs that this bill is designed to support that are having a really amazing impact on the lives of youth already. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Feist. We have four testifiers. The first of those is Kate Weeks from the Office of Officer of Justice Program. After that, we have Malaika Iban. Thank you so much for being here. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the time today to talk about the need for additional investments for youth in Minnesota. The Minnesota Office of Justice Programs currently provides grant funding for programs identified in House File 1712 through our Community Crime Prevention Grant Program, our Youth Intervention Grant Program, our federal Title II delinquency prevention funding programs, and through our crime victim services. These programs have historically offered tremendous return on investment. However, through our competitive grant process, we continually see significantly more requests than we have funding available. For example, in our community crime prevention grants, during the last competitive RFP process, OJP received $6.5 million in requests for $2.4 million available. In our youth intervention program, during the last competitive cycle, OJP received $12 million in requests for only $6 million available. And for disparities reduction, those are Title II funds from the federal government, which have been decreasing since 2002 by 85%. During the last competitive cycle, OJP received $7.7 million in requests for only $1.6 million available. The governor's budget also recommends additional investments in all of these areas as we recognize the importance of programs dedicated to prevention, engagement, intervention, reducing barriers to services, and community support. Our office maintains a commitment to ensuring that all communities have access to funding opportunities to support their critical work on a local level. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Malaika Ivan and then Mikhail Lewis. Thank you so much for being here. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you all. My name is Malaika Ivan. I am the interim executive director at the Legal Rights Center, and I'm so thankful to be here in front of this committee and members of the public today in support of House File 1712. Committee members, you have a really unique and exciting opportunity in front of you to invest in the future that you want to see, our youth in Minnesota. And here this year, with the unprecedented budget surplus that we have as a state, we have some unique opportunities to invest in prevention, intervention, and disparity reduction services that keep our young people and our communities safe. As a member of the Minnesota Coalition for Youth Justice, we work with youth and families, organizations, youth workers every day who are asking for additional resources so that they can expand programming to be proactive in relationship with young people and families before the need arises for them to be involved in the juvenile justice system. And then once that need does emerge, to have the opportunity to invest in young people and their families as quickly, effectively, and with care as much as possible. The areas outlined within this bill are diverse and have the opportunity to make sure that we're meeting a wide range of young people's needs and really building out communities of care for our youth and families across the state. I urge you to support this bill and thank you for the opportunity to really invest in a future for our children and the future of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Ivan. Now we have Mikhail Lewis and then Ukasha Duquesne after that.
Thank you, everybody, for allowing me to be here today. My name is Mickey Lewis. I'm the founder of the 8218 Truth Center. The Truth Center is a space where I created on out of pocket to make sure that we can have a safe space where kids can go. They can be mentored. They learn everything from community awareness, conflict resolution, depression and suicide, drug addiction. It's a place where they learn how to co-parent if the parents are having issues. This is not the only thing we do. What we do is we go out and we find those individuals that are shooting, that's fighting, that's doing some of the things out here that are destroying our communities. And what we do is we step in between those guns that's faced at each other, and we try to get them guys to sit down, put those guns down, and come and work it out before it turns deadly. These kids, they very much need the help to make sure that they don't continue to just fade away. These kids are hurting. I'm inside of the juvenile detention center where most of these kids, once a crime is committed, they're down there and they're struggling every day with the chance when they are able to get out. What do they do? Where do they go? Who can they be around? Well, the resources that's out here for them are struggling to be able to provide anything for those kids. So the kids, normally, they just get back out of those incarcerated situations, and the next thing you know, they're back doing the same things. The feeling of standing in between some of these kids when they haven't learned enough to put down some of those weapons or have any resources, and they feel like taking it out on each other, it's hurting all of us. To be able to mentor some of these kids and be able to mediate some of these issues that the kids are having, you know, it kind of brings me back to why we're here today. It's a lot of fighting that takes place in the upper realm of our city and our state. And those fights need to stop, just like the ones that take place down here with our kids that in these communities. We have a surplus of over $17 billion. And you mean to tell me that these communities that are struggling, that mothers are crying and babies are dying, don't deserve collectively $1 billion of that to be able to fix what's going on? The problem a lot of us have is some of us feel like that money that is there is our personal money that's coming out of our personal bank accounts, and it's not. That's the community's money. That's the people's money. And every year we fight to just say, please give us a little bit so we can save these streets that are crumbling right before our eyes. Because a lot of us need to understand, if these streets crumble on this side, it's just a matter of time before they're going to crumble on that side. If you don't take and put a fire out, that fire is going to continue to grow. So I just ask that the fighting stop for just a little bit, so that we can come together and start to fix what is going wrong in our communities that's affecting all of us. This is not just a one-sided show. This is for everybody. And my testimony is for all of us to please just figure out a way that we can help these communities, help these organizations, not just mine, but all that come in here and just ask for one time, please just give us a little help to save our kids. And in return, saving our kids is going to save some of you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And next we have Ukasha Duquesne. Thank you very much. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, my name is Ukasha Duquesne, and I am the executive director of FRAYO, a culturally specific nonprofit in Twin Cities. I am here today for one reason, and that reason is to support the House File 1712. This is personal to me. We run a program called Let It Go, which teaches the young people on how they can choose their personal power to cultivate a nonviolent communities. We teach the young people on how they can become a peace ambassadors within the community. And in the year 2022, we served more than 120 youth in our communities to learn these skills so that they can cultivate a nonviolent communities with the funding from ARP. After the funding ended, we had to let go of the program. Every day I receive calls from these young people on when we can restart our program. Nelson Mandela have one time said, those people who live in violence day in, day out, think that it's the intrinsic part of human condition, but it's not. Violence can be prevented. And our program, Let It Go, is an example of that. These are culturally specific youth who have seen violence in one way or the other, who have lived in a household whose parents have seen the significant traumatic life events in their life that had a violence. They are at-risk youth. They need our support and they need our help. We have a juvenile crimes right now increasing, and we need resources right now more than ever. So I am urging all of you today to work on this bill, House File 1712, and also put in your minds that this is a resource to underrepresented youth. It's a resource to every young person in the community. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Duquesne. I appreciate your testimony. Yeah. That's the last scheduled testifier we have. Is there anybody from the public who would like to testify on House File 1712? Yes, please come up, state your name for the record, and you have 90 seconds.
Thank you.
Yeah. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Evenstad, Evenstad, and I testify today in support of this bill. I'm all about any bill that is helpful for society, particularly for children and minors. That's been my calling for at least 25 years now. And I want to urge the committee to think about myself as a resource, because I spent 10 years in our Department of Corrections, and I counseled thousands of men. And while I don't have the experience of having talked with and met with juveniles, every single man that I counseled and administered to in prison was a juvenile at one time. And, you know, I didn't do a deep dive. I did every layer that there is in an onion to understand what causes people to go to violence. You know, is it predisposition? Is it something organic in their brains? Is it environment? And what I've learned in my 25 years is that for the most part, it's a combination of predisposition, but mostly it's what children experience. It's what children experience. When they experience a violent home, when they experience a violent community where there are solutions, MSOP is 85% white. There's not a lot of recidivism that goes on in the MSOP, is there? Why, as a state, do we not have intervention for black youth? Why isn't there a Minnesota violent offender program, but with an actual program to get people back in the community so they can be safe members of the community? Thank you for your time. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you. Next up, please state your name for the record and proceed with 90 seconds of testimony.
Thank you. Al Plowers. Hey, I'm a part of the UBLA, United Black Legislative Agenda, and we're talking about public safety. But I want to get up here because Makai Lewis was just up here speaking. I know he's on the ground. I hope when you get through that, that resources get to these avenues. This is the right thing. But I think you need to remember the parents and remember the kids. I'm up here. I'm gonna speak because you know I'm in a county where the county attorney saying they don't want to. They're not gonna. They don't want to charge juveniles as adults. I don't care about nothing like that. I care about what the parents and the victim think. I'll tell you about the 15 and 17-year-old that was told to go kill a black woman in her house, and she's not here to speak when we're talking about juveniles. So this is a lot of parenting. When you think about it, we need to make sure that the parents know. What's going on? We got to get them involved. You know, you can do all the programming in the world, but if the parents are not in the game, then it ain't gonna mean nothing. And so I'm here seeing what's happening in about the juvenile justice and everybody trying to move it. But don't forget these victims that's taking this up and families that's suffering when violence occurs. So as we're trying to do the juveniles, don't some of the victims that's been victims of homicide and robbery and murder and ask them how to do this and not so much listen to all these social justice groups that ain't talking about that. They talking about one thing. You got to talk about both of them. We got a problem in our community. I'm standing here as an African-American ADOS man that know we got a problem, and I want y'all to hear our problem. I want you to hear what we talking about in our community, with our churches, with our organizations, whether it's the NAACP or our black churches. I want you to hear.
Your time is up. Could you please?
I want you to hear our problem. The time should never be up when I'm talking about victims, but I'm going to let it go today. But hear what I'm saying. You need to be in our community asking our churches, asking our organization what we need to do. And I don't see that here today besides Makai Lewis, who I know is on the ground fighting this fight. So I hope you heard my message.
Thank you.
That we're serious about saving our community.
Mr. Flowers, I apologize for grabbing my water bottle while you were speaking as well.
Yeah,
I apologize.
Yeah, you took some of my
time.
Thank
you. We have... Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Flaherty.
I'm sorry. Could you just hold on? We have four bills up that we have to get through today. So we'll have one more testifier after this one, and then we have to cut it off from there. And anyone who wants to still have testimony for the record, you can absolutely provide written testimony to Ms. McDaniel here, and we can make sure that it is on the record. So thank you very much. 90 seconds, and please proceed.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Flaherty. I'm the founder of Hope for the Brave. Our mission is to provide safe haven while assisting women to become empowered to end the cycle of domestic violence. I am a member of the Violence Free Minnesota Coalition. I am very highly in support of the bill at hand. The My Life represents what happens when you don't have outlets for children. As a child of two young alcoholic parents, I ended up being a victim of sexual violence from a family member. Sexual violence at a young age breaks a child in an unimaginable way, and in my life, along with the lives of many others, I became promiscuous at a young age. My promiscuity caused me to become pregnant at 13 and have an abortion, to become pregnant again at 14 and have my only child. My child's father was incredibly abusive, and I stayed in that relationship for way too long because I had a broken self-esteem. When I finally did break away from that relationship 10 years later, I thought that everything would be better, but I never healed because I wasn't given resources to do that. So I ended up finding relationships just like that. Carrying further to a couple of years before my son graduated from high school, to add insult to injury, I got into a couple of car accidents, and after failed physical therapy attempts, I ended up leaning on opiates to alleviate the pain that started a 10-year opioid addiction. So I beg of you, you know, provide the resources to get the kids what they need, because they need it. They need the kid. The kids are the future. Money needs to be poured into these children. And thank you for hearing me.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for sharing your story. I appreciate it. And our final testifier on this bill, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, or afternoon. My name is LaTanya Reeves. I am the chair of the Minnesota Civilian Public Safety Commission. I am vice president of Ask Me Council 5 for the state of Minnesota, and I am president of Local 552 Probation and Parole for Hennepin County. And in that capacity as a probation officer, I am in support of this bill. We are in the field trying to make sure that we offer the services for kids in the work that we do to keep the public safe, the client safe, and the victim safe. We do recognize that there are some that may need to be incarcerated, but for the most part, we do not have access to community resources that we need to make sure that we can serve the kids and the adults that we serve in probation. As a mother of a child who's currently in prison for 16 and a half years, I begged and pleaded for help with my son. Before this happened, I saw it and couldn't get services because he wasn't in the system. So whatever we can do to prevent that so they don't get in the system would be very helpful. Perhaps if I had got that assistance when I begged when he was 11 and 12 years old, maybe he wouldn't be sitting in prison now for 16 and a half years. Luckily, my son will get out of prison when he's 30 years old, but he's been in custody almost 3 years and he's 21 years old. We have to listen to the parents in the community when we say we need these services. No matter the fact that I work in the system, I should have been able to get help and I was not able to. So I appreciate bills like this. I appreciate the fact that we're having this conversation, and hopefully we can save another child, especially the young black males. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Reeves. And so if anyone else has testimony that they'd like to provide, we can give written testimony to Ms. McDaniel, and we are going to move on to member discussion at this point. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. This has been a robust presentation, and I love your testifiers. Very much appreciate their willingness to come and speak today. And I want to talk a little bit about from the perspective of the district that I represent. The difficulty that I have in trying to translate the need for this to.
Do you mind putting the mic?
I'll start over again. So, all of the members on this committee were called representatives, and we represent a specific set number of people in Minnesota. The district that I come from is in Wright County, and the folks who I represent, 96% of them do not look like me. And the type of experience that they have on a day-to-day basis and the stories that they have to tell are not similar to the stories that are often told here in this committee. And for that reason, it can be hard to explain to them what they're getting for their money. Mr. Lewis, I believe it was, said, you know, if we could have $1 billion to solve this problem, and look, if I could go back to my constituents and say, hey, it's going to cost $1 billion if we solve crime amongst juveniles, I think they would say yes if they believed that that was true. And so basically what I want to say is that I long for the opportunity, and I hope to follow up with these organizations and these testifiers to get out in the field and do what Mr. Flowers said, to talk to people and try to understand what these organizations do and how it works and how it actually results in measurable outcomes for these affected populations. Because if we can, if that is true, if we could come to the conclusion that $1 billion will solve the problem, then that would be a really great thing to know. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Mr. Feist.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your comments. I don't know what the exact dollar amount is, but I do believe that if we invest in our young people, that that is a public safety investment, and it's one that will benefit all of us in all of our districts. I have had the opportunity to talk with so many experts, probation officers, county attorneys, restorative justice practitioners, you know, victim services providers from all over the state of Minnesota, youth struggle everywhere in every community, and the work being done all across the state, as well as within people who can come here to the Capitol and testify in person, you know, is really remarkable and impactful. I just specifically would love to call out Yellow Medicine County and Pine County, which are doing really incredible work, interventions and restorative practices with youth that have saved like so much money in out-of-home placement. Like, it's really remarkable. So I'm a data person. I would love to have more data, but I believe, and I have seen, that these are the types of investments that can have like a dramatic and positive impact on public safety and on our youth.
Representative Mueller, and we have another couple of folks on the list, and then we'll need to move on to a vote. So, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. You and I have very similar passions about making sure that our youth are cared for. I do have a couple of questions on 2.3 of the bill, line 2.3. It does say grants for local units of government, nonprofits, and other community organizations. And I just was wondering if you could give me a little clarity about what that would be.
Vice Chair Feist.
I'm so sorry. What line?
2.3.
So nonprofits.
And then other community organizations.
Other community. Well, these would. Sorry.
Vice Chair Feist.
Organizations such as the ones that testified today, and the ones that provided a long list of letters, organizations that work with communities of color, indigenous youth, queer youth, gender-based programming or gender-specific programming.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are those not nonprofits, though? So you already have in here local units of government, nonprofits.
Oh.
I'm just wondering what other community organizations.
Vice Chair Feist.
We could maybe tighten up that language, because I'm not envisioning for-profit community organizations, so I assume they would be nonprofits.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And then the only other, I was listening to your testifiers, and I think it was Director Weeks was talking about how important it is for us to have this money so it can go to our local organizations. And I have seen specifically how important it is for our local organizations, because they do the work, and they are the ones who are in our communities, right? And they know our communities the best. One of the other testifiers talked about how they used ARP funding for their program, and now because of that has stopped, they no longer have it anymore, but the community has been asking for the program again. Is there anything in your bill that would require a community local match? We know that local dollars mean local investments, which also means local effectiveness. So I don't want us to be funding organizations that frankly maybe don't match the community and aren't doing, and we do see that they're working. I'm not saying that they're not. I'm just wanting to know if we have any type of local match funding, or if that's something through OJP that they already do already. I just wanted to check that. And the only other question I have, thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair, is I was also looking at where what they would require to get a grant? Do we already have that they have a proven track record of effectiveness in order to get the grant? And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist.
Yep, thank you. Thank you for these questions. So there are, as you know, programs such as the YIP programs that do require that match, and I think that's great, and there are a lot of programs that are eligible for that type of funding under that structure. The goal here is to have a more expansive grant program that does not necessarily require that local match, although I agree that it is great and certainly an indicator of success and community engagement where they can show a track record of being able to raise funds separate and apart from the state. My goal here is to create a more expansive this is like conflicting. I was going to say more expansive and more focused, which are two diametrically opposed concepts. But I wanted to identify the types of programs that I think we should be funding and create an easier process to get them. But I know that Director Weeks has a very rigorous process for determining eligibility for these grants. So it wouldn't just be like send in an application form, get a check. There would be a process to make sure that they meet, you know, the very, very extensive kind of descriptions that we've included in this grant.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're doing a great job today, by the way. No, that's I mean that. That's not a joke. That's sincere. I think you're doing a great job today.
I got a timetable. Let's go.
All right. Representative Feist, thank you for bringing this bill. I do think it gets at what I often talk about is the upstream portion, so we're not having to pay for things on the back end by incarcerating folks on the back end. So one of the things I want to talk about, I think oftentimes when we have this conversation, and I think Representative Hudson did a great job of kind of laying it out, when we have this conversation, it often kind of revolves around the issue of race, right? But the reality is it revolves around the issue of poverty. What we know is that when we statistically look at where crime happens the most, where we see an uptick, it is often in places that have high concentrations of poverty. We can look around the state. In fact, we had a big map drawn up last year when I had the innovation package, and where we saw the most crime happening, it was in places that had the highest concentrations of poverty. Now, the sad and unfortunate reality that we have to live with is that oftentimes, those high concentrations of poverty, they fall along the lines of race. Now, those are some inequities that are built in to the systems that we have, that we've had in this country going back to the founding of it. So those are things we just have to realize that are the reality of this country. But what I always say is we have poor people everywhere. And what we have to do is find ways to invest in those areas that we haven't historically always done to ensure that we create safe communities. And I think this bill is going a long way to do that. And to the point, and I continue to hear this this narrative now that we want to make sure that we have a community match on investments before we give the resources. The reason we have to invest is because those communities don't have the resources to make that match. But what I can tell you is the way they're investing is with their time, they're volunteering, or they're putting their own money into it. Now, we may not be able to measure that always, but what we can know, we can look at and measure is, what are the participants getting out of that program that's put in place? Who's using it? And what are the outcomes we're seeing there? So thank you for bringing this bill. I know I'm a co-author, but I'm looking forward to voting for it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any further questions? All right, seeing none, Vice Chair Feist, do you have any closing comments on House File 1712, and then we'll vote.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for the great discussion. Thank you to the testifiers, including members of the public who were inspired to speak up and support spontaneously, which was very exciting. This is my vision for juvenile justice. I think these investments are effective. I think they are a smart expenditure of public safety dollars. And I'm really excited about this bill. Just to comment briefly on Mr. Flower's comments, like, victim services are a really huge part of this bill. We talk about trauma services, behavioral and mental health interventions, helping people who've been victims of gun violence. So that is a big part of this bill. And it also focuses a lot on families, so helping single parents, helping families that are struggling with domestic violence. So this bill is multifaceted, but, my vision for juvenile justice is Minnesota that we are deliberative and we are focused. And I feel like a bill like this will help us really understand how we can effectively invest in our youth. And I would encourage support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Feist. And so I misspoke there. I renew my motion that House File 1712 be laid over. And then we are going to get started. I'll let you start testify on 1511, then we'll switch here. So next bill on the agenda is House File 1511, and this is also Representative Feist's bill. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move my bill, and I think I'm moving it to the General Register.
Yes. Yep, yes, Vice Chair Feist moves that House File 1511 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. So you can move forward. Would you like to do the DE1?
You do it.
Okay. So we have a DE1 amendment, author's amendment. So, Vice Chair Feist, would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I would like to move that amendment, which is just technical and gets the bill into the shape I would like it.
Any discussion on the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Passes. And we have the DE1 amendment. So, Representative Vice Chair Feist, I keep saying that wrong, sorry, would you please discuss your bill?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a common sense expansion of an evidence-based tool to ensure that juveniles are not detained unnecessarily. As we discussed in our last bill, the criminal legal system is vastly disproportionately represented by Indigenous people and people of color. Youth of color overall are 1.6 times more likely to be placed in detention than white youth. American Indian youth are 4 times more likely to be placed in detention than white youth. Statewide expansion of the use of risk assessment instruments seeks to address these disparities. The risk assessment instrument is objectively and racially, ethnically, and gender responsive guide to decision making. There are no verbs in the sentence, but it's a neutral guide. And I'll turn it over to my expert who can actually explain what the risk assessment instrument is and why it's important to our juvenile justice system. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vice Chair Feist. And my apologies for being late. I was presenting a bill over in Capitol 120, and looks like you were in good hands with Representative Tabke. I see that you have one testifier, Curtis Shanklin. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Shanklin. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Curtis Shanklin. I have the distinct honor to serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Corrections, where I oversee the Reintegration and Restorative Services Division. Again, I appreciate y'all's time. I want to say a personal thank you to Representative Feist for bringing this bill forward, along with all the other courageous work that I know she is doing within the juvenile space. You know, I've been up here and I've had the opportunity to come and testify before you all for a number of years. And for me, that's been a great pleasure. If you've heard me talk before and a number of my colleagues, we always implore not only the committee, but the members who are sitting here and others to think about when we talk about our youth through what we call the My Child Test. That means that if your son or daughter, grandson or granddaughter, niece or nephew had contact with the juvenile justice system, how would you want their experience to be, right? And before I kind of talk about the risk assessment instrument, which has been vital, particularly to juvenile justice reform here in Minnesota, I'd like to provide some context. I believe our law enforcement partners, the women and men who put on that uniform and that badge, are courageous. It is a noble profession. And there's a history within my lineage that speaks to that. And despite sometimes their courageous efforts, the data will show we do have glaring inconsistencies across the state. Representative Feist mentioned some of those disparities that we have here in the state that not only rank high here in the state, but put us first in the nation in some of those categories. We can do better. I think it is incumbent upon us to do better. Here in Minnesota, we talk about and we hear narratives around our youth. I myself am an African-American black man. We are not a monolithic group or community. Right. On any given year, 70 to 75% of the youth who come into contact with the justice system come into contact for what we consider our part two offenses. Those are our lesser persons or property crimes. The vast majority of our youth are not engaging in what we consider our part one offenses. Now, that does not mean that those youth should not be held accountable. You will never hear me say no youth should ever be placed in secure confinement. That's just not the reality. Unfortunately, sometimes our youth make some very poor choices that warrant them to be placed in secure confinement. But we also have to do that in the most objective way possible. Because what we do know is once a youth is introduced to secure detention, the chances of them committing a higher crime, potentially a felony, increases by over 60%. I think the other thing that is important to point out is that when we talk about the diversity of our youth who do come into contact with secure confinement, 60% of our young women are victims and survivors. They too come into the contact with the juvenile justice system. How would we want their experience to be, and what tools are we using to make sure that the quote-unquote right youth are the youth that we are placing in secure confinement? The risk assessment instrument is a validated tool that is used at the point of intake. It is to help guide those decisions on who we do place into secure confinement. You will hear another bill that will be presented later that speaks to some of the practices that youth can be exposed to once placed in secure confinement. I want people to keep in mind that here in Minnesota, the age of delinquency is 10. 10. That's typically a fifth grader, right? So we're talking about people as young as 10 years old being placed in secure confinement. We should keep that in mind. Again, when you think about your daughter or your son who could potentially be 10 years old and could be placed in secure confinement, right? Minnesota went on this reform track, particularly with JDAI, the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, over 20 years ago. At that point in time, we had detention facilities that were overcrowded, and we're looking for a way to drop those numbers. With the work of the Annie Casey Foundation, Minnesota adopted the JDAI model. We were able to decrease our detention facilities by over 80% at its highest point. The precipitous drop that we see was in large part to the use of a risk assessment instrument at the point of intake. This was without compromising public safety, and it saved communities and counties and taxpayers millions of dollars. I wonder, when we talk about this risk assessment instrument, it's also important to mind that this is just between that 36-hour window and when a youth comes into detention and when they will have their first court appearance. It is an objective tool that helps take into consideration a couple of factors: their level of offense, pending and prior history, aggravating and mitigating factors. At that point in time, the person at the detention facility has the opportunity then to use that tool to help guide their decisions on who they will take into secure detention. I think the other thing that is important to understand is when we talk about our detention facilities, who really have the option to let into their facilities who they so choose. There have been a number of instances where detention facilities have refused to accept youth into their facilities. So you get our courageous law enforcement partners sitting in the car with the youth that they feel might be a threat to public safety, only to find that a detention center will not accept them or take them in. At times they will say that is because of overcrowding and other things. That is important, because it's important for us then to make sure that we're objectively placing youth in secure confinement, so then when our law enforcement partners need that bed or when they need a place to place this youth, that they have access to that. The last thing that I would just say is, when we talk about, you know, our youth and our kids, whether we're talking about here in the metro, where we're talking about greater Minnesota, where we're talking about across our 87 counties, the one distinct and the one common denominator is youth and kids. We talk about rehabilitation because our youth are malleable. They have the opportunity to change, but we have to give them those resources because our youth come to us broken. So really what this is about is our decision as a state on whether we want to be, if this is about being punitive, or is this about finding ways in which we can still hold youth accountable and still do that in a restorative justice type model. Again, I appreciate you all's time today. A sincere thank you to Representative Feist, and I will yield for any questions that members of the community might have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Before we go on to member questions, do we have any members of the public who wish to testify in this bill? Okay, come on down. See Mr. Evanstad. You know the 90 seconds, so come on up and do introduce yourself one more time again for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Chair Mueller. My name again is Tom Evanstad. That hasn't changed. And I'm testifying briefly on this bill from a personal perspective, and it ties into the bill after the next, the cannabis bill. My sister, when she was 16 years old, and she was a juvenile at that time, she's 16 years old. I grew up out in Edina, and my sister went to pick up a stick of weed, you know, a joint, down on Lake Street and Hennepin Avenue, because
because it's illegal, you know. And I want to shout out to Paul Gazalka. I believe I see him in the room. So what my point is that my sister went to get some cannabis at 16 as a juvenile. And then my sister wound up being pimped and beaten and raped from Los Angeles to New York. So I'm not really sure where law enforcement was in that equation. But, you know, be that as it may, I'm here to testify in support of this bill and anything. And then when my sister was returned, she was returned to me. I went to the doorbell at 6005 Leslie Lane in Edina, and a Minneapolis police officer gave my family back, my sister. And you know what he told me? I'm the one that answered the door. He told me that it was against policy to bring my sister from Minneapolis to Edina, but that when he saw her on the streets and he convinced her that there was only two paths ahead of her, the graveyard, and the other one was bad too, I don't even remember. But anyway, my point is this: real police will violate policies to save lives, and that would be very helpful in this case because one of them is already gone. Thank you, Chair Mueller. God bless you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Anybody else from the public on this bill? All right, we're going to move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question might be best answered by Deputy Commissioner Shanklin. This both confuses and concerns me, the fact that we have a perceived need to require objective criteria in determining whether or not a juvenile should be detained or released. One would assume that that's the status quo. It's apparently not. Can you go into some more detail regarding what is the current process being used to assess whether or not a juvenile should be detained in a secure facility or released in some fashion?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, good question. I can speak to, as someone who used to work at a detention facility myself for a number of years, within our JDAI sites, I'll start with them, they use an objective tool. So at the point of intake, what happens is because they become so well-versed, particularly with the collaborative effort with law enforcement, they have an understanding of what the tool will kind of dictate based on prior youth being brought in. And so what happens is there's typically a phone call that I'm going to bring a youth up to the facility based on what would be their potential score. There then is a conversation on whether or not that youth will be admitted into the facility. Keep in mind that there is an override component to this tool. So if you're a law enforcement officer and say that they're, because the score itself doesn't potentially suggest that the youth should be automatically placed in secure confinement, you can request an override to have that youth overridden and placed in confinement based on other potential aggravating factors. In those facilities that don't use an objective tool, you know, it's really based upon their intake criteria. So you will have a law enforcement partner particularly bring a youth up to that facility. At times they might call first, at times they might come in with that youth. And then based on, I guess, the dynamics of that facility, maybe staffing, maybe how many youth are there, a decision is made on whether or not they will accept that youth. Of course, there are times when a youth might be, say, under the influence. At times, at those times, typically, you know, that conversation leads the youth to taking that youth to, say, a hospital or something to get them medically cleared before they can be brought into the facility. We don't have a juvenile detox within the state like we do, you know, for adults. So the decision, again, can be very subjective. Across the state is inconsistent. There's no uniformity. And I think that's another important part to this tool. I think it gets us to the point where we have consistencies so that we can get out of this kind of justice by geography.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My follow-up would be, I'm trying to reconcile the word objective with what follows in line 110 and 111. Must use an objective and racially, ethnically, and gender responsive juvenile detention risk assessment. What does that look like? What are the objective criteria related to those categories, race, ethnicity, and gender, that would factor into this type of instrument?
Madam Chair, Representative, another good question. So when you speak to those, that's the validation of the tool. So that is to suggest that those three criteria will not impact the decision that is made from the tool, so that it excludes those things. And what it takes into consideration, again, is aligned with current offense, prior and pending, criminal history, aggravating and mitigating factors.
Anything further?
Just that I like that answer. Thank you very much.
Right, your member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, you described the Part 2 crimes for the committee here. Can you describe what those Part 2 crimes are?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, good to see you. Our Part 2 offenses would be, could be anything considered fifth-degree assault, disorderly conduct, loitering, curfew, those type of things. That's a Part 2. Our Part 1 offenses where would be your homicides, aggravated robbery, rapes, and so on.
Representative
Bonney. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Deputy Commissioner Shankler, and that's what I was thinking, because I was thinking, what are the times that we would send a juvenile to holding and secure holding, and most of the state for a juvenile will result from a domestic assault arrest, which is by state law mandatory hold. So how does that play into the statistics that we're talking about here?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Biden, if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're speaking to potential domestic offenses, and how does that play a role into the, is that what you're?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, yes, you talked, you know, you were citing some of the numbers that are Part 2 crimes. If domestic assault, I feel will probably play a pretty big part of that Part 2 crimes that right. People are being held for.
Okay.
Would you agree that that's something that's going to slew the numbers?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Vody, I wouldn't necessarily say that it would be something that would skew the numbers. You know, I know that in a number of our 87 counties and jurisdictions across the state, particularly the response to domestic violence because of the complications that lie within that, you know, it can be hard to discern from that exactly. So the numbers will bear out and will speak to what of those offenses account for domestic violence. But again, I think that's important, and that's why I mentioned the override, because what we do know with domestics, it can be very complex. You know, that could be a sister and a brother. That could be people who are in a, you know, intimate relationship and other type of relationships. And so it could be as simple as, to your point, where it might score as a misdemeanor. But it could be that because of the dynamics at that particular home, they would not warrant that youth to be able to go back there, right? And because we have, I think we have roughly around 312 shelters across the state, many of which will not accept, you know, someone who has any type of history of aggression, behavior, and those type of things. So where that might be a typical place that might be amenable for a youth in that type of situation, we do have equipped with this tool is the ability to override. So they can take into consideration a special circumstance like that, and because of the dynamics, and request an override that will then have that youth held to their initial court appearance.
Representative Bonney.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And continuing on that, you described that there's, tell me if I'm wrong, 80% reduction in the amount of juveniles that have been placed in secure holding due to changes. So what is something that someone could be held for?
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, so when I talked about our 80% decrease at its highest point in our detention facilities, that was because when we first took on, when counties like Hennepin and Ramsey first started using the risk assessment instrument, what they were able to see, and when you look at then across the state, St. Louis County came in after that, Dakota County, what we were able to see again at its highest point was an 80% decrease in the number of youth who were in those particular facilities. And so when we're still talking about that point of coming into the facility, those youth, again, for Part 1, based on their score, still can be subjected to be then, based on that score alone and other aggravating factors, could still be produce a score that would help the person making that decision that would then determine that youth should be placed in secure confinement.
Representative Bonney.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So do you have this form that we could look at, or the scoring that you're proposing for the statewide uniform?
And Deputy Commissioner, if you have that, that's something that we can make available to the committee later.
Madam, yeah, Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Vidy, I can get you that form. Each of our jurisdictions, they use the model, there's a collaborative effort to then take that model and make and tailor it to their jurisdiction, right? So if you take a place like Wisconsin, they use what we call a DRE. So they have one risk assessment instrument that the entire state uses, and that's what you have to use. Here in Minnesota, we know that there's uniqueness within our 87 counties and our jurisdictions. So what you still use the model, but then there's a collaboration of folks that includes law enforcement, county attorneys, public defenders, social services, probation. They all come together and then tailor that tool to their population and their jurisdiction. But I could get you, again, for each of our counties that use it, how those offenses rank and score based on the model.
And Representative Botney, hopefully one, you're one, pissed one, about one, that. One. All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. If we look at the major crimes, carjacking, which is auto theft by robbery, burglary for second degree, are those going to be, would that fit into the grid as a mandatory hold?
I believe it's subject, yes. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, yes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. Any closing comments, Representative Feist?
Objective metrics are good, so I would encourage members to support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 1511, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you for your testimony, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it. All right, next up we have House File 1233, Representative Pinto's bill. And I will move that we're laying over House File 1233. And while Representative Pinto makes his way to the testifier table, I believe that you have an A5 amendment. Representative Pinto, would you like to move your amendment?
I would like to move that amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Do you want to explain what the amendment does, or is it easier for us to just adopt it?
You know, I'll just say, Madam Chair, that the amendment makes significant changes in response to a number of points and concerns that have been raised by folks. I think it'll make sense if members are okay just adopting it to get in the form that I wish, and then we'll discuss the bill.
All right. Any discussion to the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A5 amendment is adopted. Great. Representative Pinto, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll maybe invite the testifier who's going to be with me to come up because I know we're very tight on time. House File 1233, pardon me, as amended, is a bill that was advanced through this committee and through the body last year with strong bipartisan support, for which I'm grateful. It addresses two particular concerns relating to juvenile detention. One is the holding of young people in a solitary confinement, or what is called disciplinary room time, for the purpose of discipline. I should note that there may and certainly are going to be circumstances where it's necessary for a young person to be isolated for the purpose of the safety of themselves or to others, but we want to make sure that there are strict safeguards around that, and we do not want to have that happen for the purpose of discipline. And we know that that has a significant negative impact on young people. The other issue addressed in the bill is to prohibit strip searches, visual inspections of unclothed breasts, buttocks, or genitalia, except in certain limited circumstances. I'll note that there's robust reporting in the bill. I know that we'll get to all that, but I think it makes sense to be hearing from our testifiers, and then we'll have a discussion about the bill. Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I see Commissioner Schnell is here. Come up to the testifier table. Welcome Commissioner. And you know the drill. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Paul Schnell, the Commissioner of Department of Corrections. I'm going to make my testimony very brief. We stand in support of this bill. We know that this is an issue of significance and real importance. As the bill proposes, there is a prohibition against the use of separation isolation for disciplinary purposes, which we believe makes sense. And then it sets in motion a process by which we would do rulemaking to work with the partners to ultimately establish a way forward and provide clarity that we believe would be best for young people as a policy in our state. And with that, I will conclude my comments.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Next up, we have Tamara Hill, and then on deck, we have Malika Eben. So if that person on deck wants to make their way down too, that would be helpful. Hi, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, good morning, Chair, committee members. Thanks for having me today. My name is Tamara Hill. I'm a registered lobbyist and policy officer at the Center for Victims of Torture, which is a nonprofit that's headquartered in St. Paul, but we have offices in the U.S., Africa, and the Middle East. I manage and lead our Healing, Incarceration, and Policing program, which advocates for legislation that uplifts and supports our clients and communities in Minnesota while increasing equity and accountability in our public safety infrastructure. We have a long history of advocating for the basic rights of people, and because of that, we strongly encourage you to support this House File 1233. It covers and supports the basic human rights of children in Minnesota. CVT has consistently advocated for an end to practices of isolation and confinement as punishment. And we've worked with advocates and people who have endured solitary or similar isolation in many different capacities, including at Guantanamo Bay and in U.S. ICE detention. The stories we're hearing from children in Minnesota mirror the experiences we hear from other people we've worked with around the world and in our country. And that should be a devastating wake-up call to Minnesotans. When a child is sentenced to detention, the detention is the punishment. Cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment is not included in that sentence. And more to the point, children are detained so they can be helped, so they can receive treatment and guidance. And instead, our state's excessive use of DRT hurts them, not just by preventing their healing, but actively making their trauma, mental health, and distrust for law enforcement and our carceral system worse. Our legislator has the opportunity once again to end this unconscionable practice in our state. And protecting the rights of children who are detained is imperative to maintaining the integrity of our state's values. It establishes expectations and standards in our prisons and keeps our community safer in the long run. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Malika Avon. And then on deck, we had a number of public testifiers sign up. So Elliot Abutai, if you want to make your way down, and Matthew Bauer as well. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mueller, Vice Chair Feist, and the rest of the committee. Thank you for having me again. My name is Malika Avon, and I'm the Interim Executive Director at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis and a member of the Minnesota Coalition for Youth Justice. In all of the discussions that we're having today about youth, I want to reiterate the point that Deputy Commissioner Shanklin made, that we're talking about children, children who can be as young as 10 years old. We're discussing the treatment of some of the most vulnerable members of our state who have already been deemed by the court to be in need of specific services. Locking children in cells to punish them is torture, plain and simple. It's a practice that has been deemed unacceptable by the United Nations and by the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. It's counterproductive to the rehabilitative goals of the juvenile justice system and our correctional institutions. And yet, the practice is rampant. Data obtained from CARE 11 News shows that since bill language that is in front of you around solitary confinement was introduced in 2021, language that has passed with bipartisan support from this committee in past years, there have been more than 4,000 times that children in our state, again, as young as 10 years old, have been locked in a cell by themselves for up to 23 hours. This is not the equivalent of a timeout or sending a child to their room for punishment if you were their parent. If any of us here today were doing this to children in our homes, child protection would be at our door, arresting us and bringing the child to a safe place. Additionally, we must protect the children in our care from the trauma of enduring inspections while naked in correctional facilities. These strip searches happen across the state, not only when children arrive in facilities, but after visits with their families or as the result of the behaviors of other children or incidents in other facilities. The youth in our correctional facilities are disproportionately children of color, LGBTQ plus youth, children who have experienced trauma, children with disabilities, children who have experienced sexual violence, again, some as young as 10 years old. As it relates to the concept of youth safety or safety in our facilities, avoiding trauma should be a central consideration. House File 1233 just scratches the surface of the basic care that we should be providing to young people in our facilities. They deserve your swift action today. Thank you for your support.
Thanks for your testimony. And as I mentioned, we had several members sign up to testify. So we've got Elliot Butai. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Members, my name is Elliot Butai with NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We support this bill and promoting trauma-informed practices for our youth. Excuse me. One way we like to think about trauma-informed practices is instead of asking what's wrong with you, we ask what happened to you. While this bill is focused on prohibiting these traumatic practices, it's also important to talk about the alternatives. The rules that were referenced earlier, 2960, or also known as the umbrella rule, they have clear requirements for seclusion and restraints. They should only be used in an emergency for safety, and they must end when the threat of harm ends. They should be overseen by a mental health professional or a program administrator. Staff must receive training, and they also require detailed documentation for each incident. There are none of the same guardrails for disciplinary room time. The rule is clear that disciplinary room time is a punishment for a rule violation. We're empathetic to the many detention facilities that are under-resourced. We know it will require resources for training, staff, and technology, but the simple response is that if we need more resources to end these practices, then this legislature must provide those resources. Finally, when we're talking about Minnesota's juvenile system, we're talking about disproportionately Black and Indigenous children. Right now, our policies show that we're okay asking some children what happened to you, while we're still asking other children what's wrong with you, and we need to change that. So we urge you to support this bill, and thank you for the chance to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Matthew Bauer and then Ed Reynoso on deck.
Right. Madam Chair and committee members, good morning. My name is Matt Bauer. I'm the superintendent at Dakota County Juvenile Services Center. I'm the co-chair of the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, Mental Health Subcommittee. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, MACAC, and the Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association, MNJDA, at today's hearing. I have nearly 30 years' experience working with youth in juvenile justice facilities. The Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association, or MNJDA, serves youth with the highest risk and the greatest needs. These are the youth that have nowhere else to go in Minnesota and have been determined by courts to be unsafe in our communities. We are committed to providing these youth our best services, including providing them an opportunity to be the best they can be. We cannot do this in an unsafe setting. We are concerned that the complete elimination of disciplinary room time without a safe and viable alternative could lead to increased assaults, unsafe situations, and further trauma for the youth we serve. We do thank Representative Pinto for the revisions that were recent. Those are certainly provide us with some parameters and help to keep the youth safe. I want to continue by just saying DRT, disciplinary room time, was written into our licensing rule 20 years ago. It is not the name we chose or would choose today, because youth should not be isolated as a form of discipline, but rather only when it is necessary to keep youth safe. As stakeholders, we strongly endorse revision and reform, but we need to have a voice as practitioners and subject matter experts. Seclusion, as written in Minnesota licensing rules, is not a viable replacement for DRT. It requires a staff person to constantly look into a room and monitor the youth. The youth do not want this, nor is this a trauma-informed care. I would ask you to refer to my written testimony where I interviewed 26 youth at the Dakota County Juvenile Center. I explained to them what seclusion wanted. And the most common response by those youth was it would be uncomfortable, and I would not be able to calm down if someone was constantly watching me. So as written in rule currently, seclusion is not a viable replacement for DRT. But I will reemphasize, reform is needed, and we are committed to doing better. In closing, MNJDA is reducing the use of room time by increasing our evidence-based practices, our incentive-based programming, our safety stabilization planning. We agree with support further reform. We have made great strides to meet the growing mental health and trauma needs of youth, while other programs and services in our state have disappeared. We ask that we are allowed an opportunity to partner with the Minnesota Department of Corrections and others to update the licensing standards around room time so we can provide a safe environment for youth to become the best they can be.
Thank you. Yeah, yes. Thanks so much for your testimony. All right, next up we have Edward Reynoso. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. If you can keep it to 90 seconds, too. We had given that warning in advance, but I'd forgotten to say.
I'll be very brief, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today, first of all. for both you and the committee members. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Local 320. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity today, and I certainly want to thank Representative Pinto for the A5 amendment. We were prepared yesterday to testify about concerns that we had. The A5 amendment has somewhat eliminated the majority of them. Now, I'd like to take a step back and say that our corrections institution and our communities are in a crisis right now regarding mental health. We need to do better. Also, when it comes to some of this language in this bill, a lot of it could be averted if we installed full-body scanners. It's instituted in our airports. It's used in some corrections facilities. And quite frankly, if they could do it in Tennessee and Arizona, there's no reason why we can't do it here. There are a couple issues that I'd like to point out, just to point out a little bit of our concern. And you know, I'm pretty confident that we're going to be able to work some of these concerns out with Representative Pinto. On line 1.15, healthcare professionals performing searches. I can tell you right now that healthcare professionals do not and will not, in most cases, search some of the residents if they are asked to. So to have that in the bill, I don't know whether it really works, but we're a little concerned that's listed as an option. Secondly, the other thing I want to point out is on line 1.18, trauma-informed search techniques. We hope that the department steps up and trains our individuals. We represent about 800 folks in this industry. We hope that the Department of Correction does everything they can to make sure that they train our personnel, our members, and the entire process is open and transparent. We hope that Commissioner Schnell just mentioned, working with partners at the rulemaking, we hope we are have a seat at the table. We believe as the workers that perform these jobs out there, we believe we should have a seat at the table. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. We're going to move on to member discussion at this point. The A1 amendment, it's my understanding, has been withdrawn. I'm seeing some head nods for that. So member discussion. Oh, yeah, Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Commissioner Schnell. I moved fast. I was just wondering, looking at the language around DRT and wanting to make sure we go as far as we possibly can, which I think is important, at DHS licensed facilities, do they allow DRT for safety reasons, like at all?
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, I'm not going to be the best person to answer that question. I know that this is a joint rule, which is one of the things that's unique about this, is that this relates both to DHS and DOC, this particular rule.
And I'm seeing that Ms. Davis is here and was available to answer questions. So if you want to come introduce yourself, and if you can answer that question as quickly as possible, that would be great.
Absolutely. Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Sarah Davis. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm the Director of Children and Families at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. To answer the question, DHS licensed facilities are allowed to use seclusion, but not disciplinary room time or solitary confinement. It's in Rule 2960. DOC licenses are allowed to use solitary confinement or disciplinary room time, but DHS facilities are not allowed to under their licensing rules under 2960.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Anything further?
Thank you. I appreciate that answer. And it seems to be like if DHS licensed facilities don't allow DRT in any scenario and can use seclusion instead, that maybe we want to consider that as well. All right. Any further member discussion? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler, and thank you, Representative Pinto. The bill, as most people know, I'm a co-sponsor on, and I just wanted to thank you for working with the people that are involved with this all the time and taking my suggestions and working with that, and I think it's a good thing to do, and I think we will be a better place for doing this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill. One quick question I want to ask. I think it was the superintendent testified that he's interviewing folks that have been, young folks that are detained, and he said that they would prefer to have DRT. I just want to be clear. Those were interviews of youth that are currently detained. Is that correct?
Well,
Superintendent, I don't know if you
can. Yeah, and I don't want to.
You don't want to bring it back down? Okay, all right.
Yeah,
I just wanted to clear. Okay, I think that's what it is. All right. So what if a youth, for the strip searches, if a 10-year-old said, I don't refuse to have the strip search, what happens to that 10-year-old if they refuse to allow the strip search?
Representative Pinto.
And maybe Ms. Davis may have a sense of that. I mean, I think that, if we're talking about a strip search that's allowed to happen and the young person, child, refuses, I don't have expertise on that, I will say, Representative Frazier or to the chair, but give any...
Ms. Davis?
Anybody does?
Thank you very much for that. I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner Shanklin to speak to that.
Okay, we really need to wrap this bill up. We have a lot of people waiting to testify on our next bill, so... if you could just quickly introduce yourself again and answer that question.
Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin, Minnesota Department of Corrections. Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, to answer your question, currently if a youth refuses to be strip searched, particularly at the point of intake, typically they are placed in a isolating cell by themselves until they decide to comply with said search.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
One more
question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may actually be for Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin as well. Are there any empirical studies that says DRT is the best practice?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, good question. No, there are not. As in fact, all accredited national organizations have come out against this practice, including the American Bar Association, that has come out and used distinct language that it says any searches conducted by anyone who is not a medical practitioner is deeply traumatizing to that youth. And I would just also point out, to the point about medical practitioners not being around to conduct these searches, currently in rule right now, if someone wants to conduct a cavity search on a youth, they have to have a medical licensed practitioner either conduct that themselves or aid or be present for that to happen. So it's already in rule that medical practitioners are involved and have to be involved with these searches.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. They were good questions. So, all right. Any closing comments, Representative?
I just need to give a shout out to the Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, also Katrina Dexter's with them, because they were the folks who brought this bill to me in the first place. And this would be a great step forward to pursue. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee.
All right. Appreciate with that, I will renew my motion and lay over House File 1233 as amended. And now, last but not least, the bill that many of the people are here for in the audience today, House File 100, Representative Stevenson. I will move House File 100 be re-referred to the Committee on Economic. If people in the audience can quiet down, please. I will move that House File 100 be re-referred to the Committee on Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Representative Stevenson, I understand you have the A57 amendment. I will move the amendment. Can you please explain it to us?
Yes, Madam Chair, the A57 is an author's amendment that incorporates a lot of changes that we've been working on as we've been moving through committees, including some changes that members have brought and some that stakeholders have brought. In particular, I will highlight it significantly increases the civil penalties in the bill in order to control the illicit marketplace. It also makes some data changes that are a result of some great work with Representative Scott. It also further modifies the DWI and other sections of the bill to respond to the recommendations of the DWI task force. I guess in the interest of time, I'll leave it at that, but if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Discussion to the A57 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A57 is adopted. All right, Representative Stevenson, I'm trying to talk so fast that I don't know, mispronouncing your name.
You're good.
Please describe your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, I'll be extremely brief because I know that there's a lot of people who want to talk, and most members have heard this bill at least once before. This is the bill to legalize adult-use cannabis. Minnesotans are ready for this change. Our current laws are doing more harm than good. And with that, I'll leave it to the testifiers.
Thank you. And we have Munira Mohammed and Rihanna Buchholz. So Munir Mohammed, if you want to introduce yourself, welcome back and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair Mueller and the Public Safety Committee members. My name is Munir Mohammed, and I'm with the ACLU of Minnesota. That's the American Civil Liberties Union. We are speaking today in support of House File 100. Cannabis laws desperately need reform due to stark racial disparities in marijuana possession arrests and the fact that they haven't gotten better in Minnesota or nationwide. Nationally, on average, a black person is 3.6 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person, even though black and white people use marijuana at similar rates. Here in Minnesota, it's an even bigger problem. A black person is 5.4 times more likely to be arrested than a white person, which is significantly worse than the national average. The disproportionate targeting and over-policing of black communities for a substance that is equally used among the population is a logical consequence of marijuana criminalization and the byproduct of the failed war on drugs. Being caught with even the smallest amount of marijuana can risk your housing status, employment opportunities, child custody determinations, immigration status, and eligibility for financial aid. It can ruin lives. House File 100 is a viable path towards responsibly legalizing marijuana use for Minnesota adults. It has strong provisions that don't simply replace marijuana prohibition with onerous fines and fees that can disproportionately affect marginalized families. It also provides clemency and resentencing for certain marijuana convictions and expungement of past marijuana convictions. Full legalization would stop further arrests for possession, decrease prison populations, reduce the criminalization of black and brown communities in our legal system. The ACLU Minnesota urges you to support House File 100, and thank you to the committee for letting me speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Rihanna Buchholz. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Rihanna K. Buchholz, and I am the Legislative and Coalitions Director for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. I am here to testify on behalf of the cannabis bill and express AFP's support for its passage. We at AFP believe in a dignified approach to public policy, advocating for bottom-up solutions that help every individual achieve their full potential. We also believe in second chances and empowering individuals to use their experiences to make a positive impact for themselves and their community. HF 100 is a great example of such a transformational measure that will help right the long overdue wrongs of the war on drugs and uphold constitutional rights for individuals impacted far and wide by prohibition. We enthusiastically support the expungement measures in this legislation. The nearly 1.1 million Minnesotans with a criminal record face both societal stigma and more than 550 legal barriers in our state law alone that prevent them from accessing meaningful employment, adequate housing, and additional education. Expungement is a proven solution to true second chances that both research and actual experience in other states prove the benefits of for public safety and for our local economies. The nationally celebrated Second Chance Month is coming up in April, and passing this legislation would be a wonderful way to celebrate. We are disappointed to see that many of the new criminal penalties are being created by the legislation, and we would just like to see some of them changed to civil penalties. It's our opinion that these well-intended provisions should not create additional barriers to people achieving their full potential as we create this new industry. It's our hope that dismantling prohibition will help reduce the number of individuals who encounter the judicial system and have an unnecessary criminal record that could hinder their opportunities. That said, we are pleased at the progress made in this bill, and we look forward to supporting it on its journey through its passage. This will be a monumental step forward in several aspects of our state, and we thank Representative Stevenson for shepherding this legislation through and taking into consideration all of the various stakeholders and individuals impacted. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. We're going to move on to public testimony. We had 12 people sign up, and we actually ended up turning away some, too, because more continued to sign up. So we're going to stick to a very strict 90-second timeline here. We have Chief Jay Hinthorn and Sheriff Kevin Torgerson first. Go ahead and make your way down to the testifier table. And then on deck will be David Bernstein. So go ahead, Jay Hinthorn, introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Hinthorn. I'm the Director of Public Safety and Chief of Police for the City of Richfield. I'm here today to testify with concerns House File 100, as currently drafted, on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Our association collectively represents over 300 police chiefs across the state. As the bill has moved through various committees, legislators have said it is important to prioritize an extremely tight legal market and regulatory structure to not exacerbate an existing illicit market. Unfortunately, this bill does not do that for a variety of reasons. The registration fees and compliance checks that were added to the bill since it was introduced is a step in the right direction, and we thank Representative Stevenson for his work on that. But the bill should mirror other licensing operations that our state has had success with. Local governments should have licensing authority as they do with other retail operations like liquor stores. The significant amount of cannabis an individual can legally possess and grow at their home, this will not reinforce a tight regulatory structure through consistent retail outlets. This will create a homegrown illicit market and will lead to more work for local law enforcement. Ultimately, it will only further an already flourishing illicit market in the state of Minnesota. Our association, along with the Sheriff's Association, submitted a broader letter to the committee, including traffic safety concerns based on what we have seen in other states that have legalized adult use cannabis. Make no mistake, the bill will lead to major traffic safety concerns, and we will see a stark increase in traffic safety related deaths. We urge the legislature to make these changes through the committee process and help our local governments and agencies provide the layer of regulatory certainty that our communities expect. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Kevin Torkerson, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Sheriff Kevin Torkerson of Olmsted County and Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I hope today you will discuss the points I highlight here. At the core of our concerns is everything this committee represents: public safety, finance, and policy. Article 1, Section 4 authorizes training more drug recognition experts on Line 2211 and forced retirement replacement of current drug detection dogs on Line 2215. For my agency alone, that will cost $40,000 to replace two teams. This is not cheap, nor a standard Minnesota can accept without trained teams. Article 4, Section 40, this bill authorizes an oral fluid preliminary testing pilot project between August of this year until July of 2025. However, the bill indicates effective dates for July and August of this year or January of 2024. How can we keep public safe when the legalized marijuana is available a year and a half before we have an authorized testing procedure? Isn't that like buying a new car without safety features? There is no way public safety can be ready by August 1st or January 1st. Lastly, for nearly 20 years, the number of fatalities on our roads has been reduced nearly in half. When other states legalize marijuana, the number of traffic fatalities has increased, where one or more drivers are marijuana impaired. I'm saddened that the increased loss of life on our roads is simply collateral damage for those who wish to put a foreign substance in their body. Please listen to your traffic safety experts and work with us to keep Minnesota safe. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And then David Bernstein's next, and Linda Stanton is on deck. If you want to make your way down, welcome to the committee. Mr. Bernstein, introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. For those unfamiliar, the task force has been in existence since 1982. We are a volunteer organization, nonprofit, unaffiliated, unfunded. We are have a great diversity of perspectives of professionals that work on DWIs in all aspects of cases. The DWI task force is neutral on this bill. We understand that the purview of this bill is much broader than our group, but we are focused on the highway safety considerations. And the purpose of my testimony and the letter I submitted is to emphasize, if this bill passes, highway safety considerations must be considered and emphasized. I do want to thank Representative Stevenson and Mr. Johnson for the opportunity to have met and collaborate. I hope for that to continue. There are some inclusions in the bill at our request that help protect highway safety. There are more that would be helpful. Our goal is to make sure that the standards and laws are clear and fair, and that is to the public, to law enforcement, to attorneys, and to the courts. There are some provisions we'd like to see added that are not currently included. There's a underage drinking and driving. We'd like to see the equivalent of underage use and driving, higher standards for bus drivers, commercial vehicles. I do want to put to rest a misnomer. We're not looking to enforce people who have used cannabis 20 days ago or 2 weeks ago. We're looking at impairment, recent use, and the blood test, the oral fluid, looks at that recent use. So I really appreciate the committee's consideration, and I look forward to continued collaboration. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Next, we have Linda Stanton, and on deck, we have Eni Udoma. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Linda Stanton. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. First, the state of Minnesota does not have to link expungement and legalization. Instead, the Minnesota legislature could authorize expungements like many other states have and not legalize adult cannabis use. After all, the current bill moves cannabis from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule III drug, giving people the impression that it has become safe when there are multiple risks of harm surrounding its use. Will legalizing today's cannabis make it a safe drug? Second, adjusting criminal penalties, making them lesser offenses, will have the impact of removing their deterrent effect. How would this reduce illicit sales? Today's illegal sellers will feel freer with lesser penalties to continue their trade. The only way to eliminate the illegal trade is through deterrence and enforcement. Finally, there's no accurate roadside test to assess the level of cannabis impairment like there is for alcohol. One would hope for better tools to address the problem of impaired driving, roadway accidents, and death. Data shows that marijuana is involved in one of every four road deaths in Colorado. At a time when law enforcement resources are stretched, I would advise a moratorium on commercialization. I urge you to vote no on this irresponsible bill. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Next, we have Eni Udoma and Chris Wright on deck. Welcome. You can introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Madam Chair and members of the Public Safety Committee, thank you for having me for this moment. My name is Eni Udoma. I am from Blaine, Minnesota, and I'm nothing but a concerned citizen. I'm here today to express my total support for HF 100, a bill that legalizes recreational cannabis and expunges marijuana-related offenses in Minnesota. This bill has the potential to positively impact public safety and provide relief to those who have been subjected to harsh criminal penalties for marijuana offenses. The current Minnesota marijuana laws impose strict criminal penalties for the possession, cultivation, and sale of cannabis. These penalties not only burden the individual with a criminal record, but also add to the burden of the criminal justice system that is already strained by enough already. By legalizing recreational cannabis, we can reduce the number of individuals caught in the criminal justice system for nonviolent offenses and redirect law enforcement resources towards more pressing public safety concerns, such as violent crimes and drug trafficking. Furthermore, expunging marijuana-related offenses would provide relief to individuals who have been unfairly burdened with criminal records for nonviolent and minor offenses. These criminal records often limit their employment opportunities, housing options, access to education, and other things. By expunging these records, we can help these individuals reintegrate society and reduce the chances of recidivism. Because of these inhumane penalties, our state jails, with already enough inhumane conditions, are subjected to poor living conditions, limited access to health care, and limited access to education and employment opportunities. By legalizing recreational cannabis, we can reduce the number of individuals incarcerated for nonviolent and minor offenses, easing the state's burden on correctional facilities and improving the living conditions of those who remain incarcerated for other things.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, Chris Wright, and then Tom Evanstad on deck. Go ahead.
Hello, I'm Chris Wright, Legal Marijuana Now Party. Madam Chair and committee members, the only reason why I urge you to support HF 100 is because we get more justice from the legalization by fraud than the criminalization by fraud. But fraud is fraud. Article 13, Section 7 of the Minnesota Constitution says, any person may sell or peddle the products of the farm or garden occupied and cultivated by him without obtaining a license, therefore. That does not mean license required. Defrauding us of our right against licensure is illegal and unconstitutional. Unrestricted by the Constitution, those who perjure their solemn oath to uphold the Constitution and sacrifice Minnesota's liberties at the altar of venal commercial legalization are traitors. Legalization at the cost of liberty is tyranny. I've attached a rewritten bill that complies constitutionally, but you're not interested in constitutional compliance. When it comes to cannabis.
Sir,
Yes.
We have all taken an oath to the Constitution, so you just continue about the bill, please.
Okay, I will. anyway, if lawmakers won't obey the law, then why should anyone else? Instead of putting criminals out of business, this bill drives up prices to black market levels, subsidizing criminals who can undercut the legal market. The sick and dying can afford seeds, but instead are forced to buy overpriced cannabis from those who profit and raise tax revenues from their misery.
All right.
Cannabis makes
you
cough. Politics makes
you
gag.
Thank you. Thank you. Tom Evanstead, you're on deck, and then we have, or you're up next, excuse me, and then Carly Stark is on deck. If I'm calling you on deck, please make your way down, and then after that, we have John Barty III. Welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. That's a tough act to follow, but I'll do the best I can here. I'm testifying today as a liaison with Law Enforcement Action Partnership. And the testimony is in written form today in the packets. I urge all committee members and, of course, me following at home to click on their link. The date is the date. The position is support to the House Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee, distinguished members, etc. Thank you for your opportunity to testify today in support of HF 100, which would legalize the possession, cultivation of cannabis and manufactured cannabis products for responsible adult use. I am representing myself, having spent my career as a police officer and as a speaker and executive board member for the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, LEAP. LEAP is a nonprofit group of police, prosecutors, judges, and other criminal justice professionals who speak from firsthand experience. Our mission is to make communities safer by focusing law enforcement resources on the greatest threats to public safety, working toward healing police-community relations, and addressing the root causes of crime. Marijuana prohibition affects families and communities by increasing the danger of drug misuse. Years ago, my son was looking to experiment with a drug, but was scared away from marijuana by its illegal status. Instead, he used spice, a synthetic drug that caused him to overdose and suffer psychological problems to this day. The drug war has not protected our children. Instead, it has increased the misuse and abuse of drugs. When a drug is illegal, we have no control over it. Nobody needs a license to sell it, so drug dealers can sell it to young people. There's more, but in respect of the committee, it's in a written testimony. And again, I thank you for your time. I urge your support, myself, to pass this bill. And on behalf of LEAP, as you just heard, they're in support of the bill as well. Thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carly Stark is next, and we have John Barty III and Marcus Harkis. Go ahead, Carly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carly Stark, Public Safety Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Our association represents all 87 counties in Minnesota. While AMC membership is divided on the broader issue of cannabis legalization, members are united in three broad principles. First, legalization efforts should include a strong role for local control and authority to ensure successful administration, enforcement, and public safety, as well as allow for local communities who are represented by elected leaders to decide what's best for their residents and community members. Second, any legalization effort should have a strong, thorough, and expansive regulatory framework that ensures product quality control, education, inspection, and licensing duties, and include opportunities for local government participation and meaningful review. Third, any legalization effort should acknowledge that local governments will be on the front lines of responding and dealing with effects of legalization, and as such should have access to a portion of any new revenue to offset programmatic costs and lessen impacts to property taxpayers and existing operations. We want to ensure that AMC has the, or that counties have the resources to prevent and address potential increases in cannabis use by juveniles, adequately provide investigation and mitigation of illegal grow operations, effectively address increases in driving while impaired crimes, and providing training of additional drug recognition evaluators. These costs are in addition to costs related to inspection, public health education, youth and family outreach, and more. We hope to continue working with the author to address the concerns of counties and the communities we serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have John Barty III, Marcus Harkis on deck, and Cameron Tyler. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hello, my name is John Barty. I'm the Government Affairs Manager for Uniflora Holistics. I'm going to be reading the testimony of a Michigan resident, someone who grew up in Minnesota, but was criminalized for cannabis. It reads, my name is Justin Carter. I was raised in the neighborhoods of Potterhorn Park and George Floyd Square. I graduated from Roosevelt High School, class of 2001. At the age of 21, I was convicted of a violent crime and was sentenced to 36 months in prison. Once released from prison, I found it extremely difficult to find employment that paid enough to sustain my bills. In 2008, I was given an opportunity to work in the cannabis industry in Colorado, working in both a cultivation facility as well as a retail store making $15 an hour. This was my introduction into a lifelong career. I met my wife, started my family, and purchased my first home, all while in the cannabis industry. Since 2008 until present, I've operated in 10 states as a consultant, opening 19 retail locations, 10 cultivation processing facilities, 5 consumption lounge facilities. I'm currently working as sales director for a company in Michigan. I've done all of this and supported my family all while working in the cannabis industry as a felon. A personal and professional dream of mine would be to move my family back home to Minnesota and finish my career as an owner-operator in the state of Minnesota's cannabis industry. I understand that there's a new bill in motion to legalize cannabis in the state of Minnesota. I'm writing this letter in hopes that whoever makes a decision on whether felons can own, operate, or work in the industry in Minnesota must please take into consideration my story. I'm a felon that has done my time and now a productive citizen working cannabis. Please consider how many of us there are. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. Marcus Harkis, then we have Cameron Tyler and Ted Gladdy. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Marcus Harkis. I'm the Community Relations Manager of Uniflora Holistics, Minnesota Cannabis Company. Y'all are invited to visit our headquarters in Brooklyn Center. I'm here to testify on behalf of the thousands of Minnesotans who may be discriminated in employment or entrepreneurial opportunities in Minnesota's emerging legal cannabis industry when prohibition ends. You know, the real reason law enforcement lobbies and the treatment industry have been fighting against legalization is because they profit from prohibition. That has to stop. I do want House File 100 to pass this year, but I want the provisions in the bill that would establish a prohibition-like model to be removed. Cannabis should not be regulated more strictly than alcohol. The low purchase and possession limits proposed are better than what we have now, but still draconian. We must end the drug war in a way that is equitably regulated, reasonably taxed, and justly repairs all prohibition victims, not just misdemeanors with the expungement process. Expunging felonies must be prioritized. The purpose of ending prohibition is to cease criminalization. And we must advocate for a state and local government level paradigm shift that opposes treating Minnesotans like second-class citizens for the rest of their lives. Whether it's a cannabis conviction or most others, our people have long paid their penalties and rehabilitated their own lives against the odds. I don't have a criminal record, but I know, you know, my friends and family, they've been haunted for years, like Cameron Taylor. And some of the best people, cannabis industry leaders, like Mason Ault and Justin Carter, could be potentially barred from entering the cannabis industry in Minnesota if we don't correct, you know, House File 100. So let's keep it moving, but let's get it done right, please.
Thank you. Cameron Tyler, and then the last person we have on the list is Ted Gladdy. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Cameron Taylor. Good afternoon, members of the committee and everyone else here. My name is Cameron Taylor, and I was called here today to speak briefly about my experience within the criminal justice system, which occurred from my fifth-degree felony marijuana possession charge back in August of 2012. Since that conviction, making a livable wage for my family became extremely difficult and nearly impossible for many years. Being denied employment and housing opportunities made it very evident that the goal of the state was not to grant reentry into society after time served, but more of a demeaning cycle that made me wear that the conviction of my past as a uniform instead of looking at the charge that I was committed to my future. Which is why I feel it's important that the verbiage of HF 100 include the immediate overturn of felony and misdemeanor marijuana convictions so that the affected individuals don't find themselves in unsafe, redlined housing or suffer the same employment barriers that I did. Thank you for your time and opportunity that I was given to provide the voice of the face to the mute and unseen. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. My apologies for mispronouncing your name as well. And then we have Ted Gladdy, and I may be mispronouncing your name as well. Please introduce yourself and begin.
I am Ted Gladdy. I'm the owner-operator of Hemp Maze, Minnesota at Willis Keep Farm in Zumbrota, and we also own the Old Pine Theater in Pine Island, Minnesota. So the reason I'm here before you, and thank you for having me, is that HF 100, although I want to see more access to cannabis. I think there needs to be changes in this bill. HF 100 lists hemp 381 times. I'm a hemp grower. I'm a hemp processor. I'm licensed and registered through the Minnesota Department of Ag, and I want to continue to do that. I want to continue to farm my product. I want to continue to bring my product to my customers. We have a farm store that's open 7 days a week all year round, where we've helped thousands of people, as you've heard from other testifiers, get off opioids, alcohol, other drugs. Cannabis is not a drug. It isn't. You can look that up. It's not a narcotic. It's not a depressant. It actually is more closely related to a vitamin like vitamin D. We have an endocannabinoid system with receptors in our body, and henceforth, we produce cannabis in the body, so henceforth it is a hormone, and we can also ingest it. So it's very similar to vitamin D. My issue here, though, is I want to see expungement. I want to see decriminalization of cannabis. However, I feel like in this bill, there's the civil penalties, but there's also misdemeanors for not, I guess, selling it correctly. And right now, if I want to sell CBD or the low-potency THC, which is a full-spectrum product, if I do that out of my theater after this bill is, or the farm after this bill is set in place, and I do not get a license, then I guess I'm breaking the law. So henceforth, I just would like you to look at that, realize that I've been selling this product since 2019. I've been growing since 2018, and I want to keep business as usual. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We're going to move on now to member discussion. And before we have questions, we do have a few amendments. First, we have the A54 amendment. Who's offering the A54? Representative Nabani.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. When we look at the bill, and there's going to be considerable discussion over the next hour or however long we go about public safety. I had the testifier that was just taking a shot at law enforcement that they want this because they want money. I fail to understand or am knowledgeable about what money they get from enforcing crimes. That being said, law enforcement is here and they are against the legalization of marijuana any more than it already is in the state because they're worried about public safety. The gentlemen sitting in the crowd right now, guessing by the color of their hairs or lack thereof, have seen things over the time that would lead them to believe that people driving under the influence of marijuana is not good. If we look at Colorado and the statutes that have been brought up several times about what happens after legalization, we know there's going to be more injuries, there's going to be more crashes, there's going to be more deaths, because there will be more people having access to marijuana. There'll be more people that'll be mixing alcohol with the marijuana. So my bill would try to get some clarification and make sure that under the statutes that the marijuana is addressed and we get an actual description of the products that we're talking about. And that's my amendment. We change basically in several changes. We change it to cannabis flower, cannabinoid product, artificially derived cannabinoids, marijuana, and tetrahydrocannabinoids. I was never able to say that very well. And that's my thing. And with that, the point is that we're trying to get to zero tolerance for driving. When we look at talking to the drug recognition experts, they tell us that there's not a measurable amount of THC in the system that is commensurate when you talk about an 0.8 blood alcohol level. I don't think there's any measurable amount that's going to be safe. There's some amount of marijuana that would be less dangerous than than an amount of not having any, and I don't believe I'm saying that right, but we'd prefer none, and that is my amendment.
All right, thank you. Before you respond, Representative Stevenson, we do have a hard stop at 12:30. I don't know if I heard you say an hour, but we don't have an hour.
I would accept an extension, Chair, if you...
But we don't. We actually have to, like, be done with this room at 12:30. Okay. All right, Representative Stevenson.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, most of the 854 amendment is weaved into the 857 that you already adopted, but if you adopt the 854... because it's altering other sections, you'll undo some of the changes in the 857 that actually are helpful towards getting DWI law in the shape we need it in. But if you take a look, for example, just the first section, I won't walk through them all in the interest of time, but if you look at what's happening on page one of the 854, you can find the change. For example, you add language on 1.19 to 1.21. If you look at the 857, which we've already adopted, you will find that same language on 8.11 through 8.13, but if you adopt this amendment, you will get rid of the language on 8.14 and 8.15, which I believe is helpful for public safety. So, and that carries on throughout the 854 amendment. So I would ask you to withdraw the 854, but otherwise I have to ask the committee to vote it down.
Representative Motney.
Question for Representative Stevenson. Does your amendment have a zero tolerance for driving for THC?
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, as I mentioned, what this amendment does is already in the bill. I think that's – we can maybe talk in more detail about that offline in the interest of time, but I think your amendment is incorporated in large part in the 857 amendment.
Representative Novotny.
I'd like to get clarification from House Research on that.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, Ben Johnson from House Research. Both the A57 and the A54 change the same sections. The changes are not identical. The changes in the A57 would treat marijuana, THC, that list of potential products and chemicals, similar to how alcohol is treated in that you must first be driving under the influence to then be triggered as having committed a DWI. The section that the A54 changes treats it like a controlled substance other than marijuana. It's illegal currently to drive right now in Minnesota with any amount of a controlled substance in Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 in your system, and this would include any marijuana hemp-based products on that list. So they amend the same sections. The 854 creates what's being referred to as a zero tolerance, meaning any amount in the system would be a violation. The A57 treats it more like alcohol, where one must be under the influence of the substance.
Thanks for that clarification. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So many of the things that we have concerns of when it comes to the driving conduct enforcement of criminal vehicular operation of motor vehicles and things in determining under the influence. As everyone knows, but I'll say it again, there isn't a PBT test for marijuana. There's discussion on even if we can compel a standardized field sobriety test, which I don't believe we can. And then it goes down to influence, under the influence. And the way you demonstrate that is with the DRE, and we'll have bills that we'll be talking about that in a minute, but you have to have someone that can show an influence. The fact that so many of these cases that we're going to be talking about are driving involving criminal vehicular operation, by definition, there's a crash. In several of the, you know, most of those situations, there's going to be someone that's not going to be able to do a standardized field sobriety test to determine under the influence, because they're either in the hospital or they're, by definition, been in a crash, and it's easier to invalidate the field sobriety test if it's not a DRE based on that. So I'll get to this. Representative Stevenson, is there any amount that you would put or accept as an amendment at any point before this comes to a floor. Is there any amount of THC in the blood that you would consider a prima facie intoxication, like alcohol?
Representative Stevenson.
Chair Mueller, Representative Montney, I'm happy to talk to you about that between now and the floor. We would need to have a long conversation with a lot of experts, so I'm not going to answer the question directly, but I'm, as anyone in your caucus can tell you on this bill and other bills, I'm always happy to keep talking, and I will talk to you about this.
And I'll just note we have 6 minutes, and we have 3 additional amendments. Representative Novotny.
We'll withdraw the amendment.
The A54 is withdrawn. We'll move on to the A55 amendment. Who will be offering that? Representative Mueller.
It is me, and unfortunately, with my limited time, I really wanted to be able to put this in context. So once again. Here we go. Oh, sorry, I'm missing one more. So this is 5 pounds. I'm allowed to use props in committee. This is 5 pounds in the bill. It allows you to have 5 pounds for personal use. And if you do the math, I won't go through all of it. That literally is 6,800 joints. So my amendment would ask you to please change that from 5 to 1 pound. And then to, sorry, let me move my thing. Oh, I forget this thing. And then to amend the where the first degree possession from five pounds to 1 pound. Everywhere else, you would have to amend it from 2 pounds to 1, and for the second and fourth grade possession. So that is my amendment. Thank you,
Representative Stevens.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller. Now, if we had put on the other side of the table or other table all of the alcohol that you could have in your home under personal use, we would fill the whole room, and then it would be unlimited because there is no limit on the amount. You mentioned 6,000 joints. I could have 6,000 bottles of Greenvale Premium in my basement and have violated no law whatsoever. Okay, so I just want to make that point before going on to say that I do think that this 5-pound limit is subject to being modification. We're having continuing discussions with a lot of people. We're not ready to make the change today, so I'm going to ask for a no vote. But as I've said in other committees, this is a conversation worth having because of the interaction with the illicit marketplace, which is not as applicable to alcohol. And so we're going to get there. We're not there today. I'd ask for a no vote today.
Any further discussion on the A55?
Roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call.
Chair Mueller?
Aye. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. No.
Wow. Oh, thank you, Chair Mueller.
Chair votes, no.
Mueller, no. Vice Chair Feist?
No.
Feist, no. Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Novotny, yes. Representative Becker-Finn?
No.
Becker-Finn, no. Representative Curran?
No.
Curran, no. Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Ingen, yes. Representative Fraser?
No.
Fraser, no. Representative Russell?
Yes.
Russell, yes. Representative Hollins?
No.
Hollins, no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Hudson, yes. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Hewitt, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, yes. Representative Pinto?
No.
Pinto, no. Representative Tapke?
No.
Tapke, no. Representative Witte?
Yes.
Witte, yes. With 6 ayes and 9 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the A55 amendment is not adopted. Next, we'll move on to the A56. Who is the A56?
That'd be me.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the bill, we have restoration of rights and expungence of records, and most of those will be automatic. But the one thing that's not automatic is the restoration of a constitutional right. In fact, it's number 2 of most important rights. It's not automatic, and it goes before a board of people that are not judges are familiar with the case. My amendment, number 56, would change it from a presumptive that they have to ask for it and change it to a, insert not. There should be not a good reason why the right should be restored. And it also changes that the expungement board can make a recommendation, but they're not the final authorities. Just seems like of all the things we're going to do, if these people, we have several other places in your bill that you restore rights or give people the rights to purchase firearms aren't going to be considered anymore. Why aren't we then considering that in the same context of restoring your rights to get firearms?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, I think we're really, really close on this amendment. My understanding of this amendment is that it applies to not just expungements but to resentencings. If this amendment only applied to expungements, I probably would have said, let's take it. Since it applies to both, I'd like to continue to talk to you about it. So I'd ask you to withdraw it, and we can work together on it, and I'll adopt it later, adopt something later. But if you want to vote, I'd have to ask for a no vote.
I'll take the branch. I'll withdraw.
Yeah, okay. That one is withdrawn. And members, we are at 12:30. We have a hard stop, so we're going to have to recess and come back at 5 o'clock or later tonight because we couldn't get done. So as of now, we'll stand in recess to 1 o'clock in room 5. You're going. I am going to reconvene the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. We are continuing with our discussion of House File 100. Where we left off, we have another amendment, and I believe that is the A58 amendment. Who will be offering that? Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. The A58 amendment replaces the existing appropriation in the bill for peace officer drug recognition training with amount closer to what is needed if the bill becomes law. Minnesota currently has about 250 drug recognition experts. With the legalization of recreational marijuana, an additional 250 drug recognition experts will be needed. Drug recognition training for peace officers is highly specialized and a lengthy process. Initial cost for additional 250 drug recognition experts will be about $8 million to cover training, per diem, attendee, and backfill salary, and instructor and certification cost. In addition, there is a continuing education requirement for drug recognition experts. The cost will be approximately $2 million. There will be ongoing costs for continuing education and training new drug recognition experts due to attrition and retirements. Unlike alcohol, where we have roadside breath tests that measure a person's blood alcohol content, we don't have reliable roadside tests for THC, so we need to rely on expertly trained peace officers who can recognize when a person is driving under an impairment of drugs. Since Colorado became one of the first states to legalize recreational marijuana in 2012, citations for impaired driving in which marijuana was perceived as being at least one of the substances involved increased by 120% from 2014 to 2020, and that's according to a report from the Colorado Department of Public Safety. When I was a police officer, I share this story. My first call as a public information officer was at 10 a.m. A mom and her four kids, she was pushing them along in a stroller. A car came across and hit them. And he was under influence of drugs. And I remember talking about, A, the crime, but also the issue of being under the influence and driving. And then the last thing I told them was, I would recommend everyone going home and hugging their families because that's what I was planning on doing. I ask for your support for this important increase to the funding level in the bill. I know our local police departments and sheriff's offices don't have the funding for the training or the resources needed to keep our community safe. I appreciate your vote of yes on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Witte. So I agree with you that the current appropriations in the bill are not sufficient for this, but I'm going to ask you to either withdraw or I would ask for a no vote either way, because we don't yet have the fiscal note for the bill yet. It's very important to me that we have a bill that is self-supporting, that the tax revenue is sufficient to cover the appropriations. And so I have been, not just on your amendment here, but any amendment that spends money, I've been asking people to hold off until we kind of have the big picture, and then we'll do that. So I will tell you that I will commit to you that we'll do more than the $500,000 that's in the bill currently. I don't know about these exact dollar amounts, more or less. I'm just saying I'm not going to make a specific commitment, but we're not there yet. I think that we've been on the verge of a fiscal note for about a week and a half now, so hopefully we'll not be too long. But I'd ask you to consider withdrawing, and then I'm happy to work with you to get this money in. And if not, I just ask for a no vote.
Representative Novotny.
Just before we close it.
Oh, go ahead. Representative Woody.
I appreciate you looking into that. And like I said, public safety is the main focus in my concern on this one. So I will work with you, and I'll pull back the amendment.
All right, so the AF58 amendment has been withdrawn. We'll move now to member discussion. I'm going to give us 10 minutes for member discussion. Who would like to go first? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And our presence in room 5 notwithstanding, I'd just like to tip my hat to yourself and to Representative Tapke for keeping the car running on the track. Today we had a lot to cover and got through a lot of testimony. There were, unfortunately, however, a couple of folks, probably more than a couple of folks, who would have liked to testify who weren't able to. And just to shout out to a couple of them, there was Smart Approaches to Marijuana and the Minnesota Trucking Association, and their concerns were particular to the jurisdiction of our committee here in public safety. And you know, the one thing I'll note, and I'll just cut my remarks short given the time. I've been here not very long, but this is the biggest bill I've ever seen. This is absolutely massive piece of legislation, and I think it stands
wait
as a test.
Bills.
Yeah. I think that it stands as a testament to how heavy of a lift you're doing with this legislation, and I commend you for that ambition, but I think that it also ends up lending itself towards being kind of awkward and haphazard in terms of its overall effect, and that's reflected in the number of people and the diversity of concerns that have been expressed both in this committee and in others. My constituents aren't supportive of this, and so I'm going to be a no vote. I'll just note that I really appreciate your demeanor and your disposition and your approach to this process. You've been very receptive in terms of ideas, in spite of advising us to not go ahead with amendments and what have you, you're willing to have those conversations, and I hope that will continue. I'm confident that it will. And that's it. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And I'll just note, too, for the record, for those who didn't get to testify, we do apologize for that. As you know, we had many, many people sign up, and we still, if they didn't get a chance to submit a letter yet, we will still take that testimony and post that on our website and provide it via email to our members, so anybody can feel free to do that. Other member discussion. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. This is a big bill, and it's a big bill because it impacts a lot of different pieces of our law, and because it's really important, it's important that we get it right. And I know that this bill predates my time at this in this building, and that it's had many, many hands touching it. I think that one thing we have to recognize is when we do something big like this, it typically means not everybody's going to be happy, right? Like, there are parts of this that I'm not satisfied with, and I'm sure there are parts of it that your constituents are not satisfied with. But the reality is the system that we have currently isn't working. People are still using cannabis. They are still driving while on cannabis. They are procuring it from unreliable sources and individuals who there's no regulation of this substance. And so I think, given that we have been fighting this drug war since the 1980s, it's really important that we start thinking about things in a different way, because the war on drugs failed. Like, that is 100% true. It did not work the way we wanted it to. And so now we really need to rethink a lot of what we have in statute. And we have to rethink about how this has disproportionately impacted certain groups of people. And I know I sound like a broken record when I talk about that, but it is true. It's disproportionately, yeah. Representative Novotny's nodding. I do sound like a broken record. I understand that. But we have to recognize that this does disproportionately impact certain groups of people. And we've heard that from testifiers today. And so while I am not totally satisfied with this, I think that it is absolutely the right step to take. It's the right move. And frankly, Minnesotans have been waiting for it for a really long time. So I appreciate your work on this. I appreciate your willingness to continue working with us, like both sides of the aisle, all the stakeholders involved, because I think it's important.
Further member discussion? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead. Representative Curran.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief here. So this came up in our community maybe about a month or so ago, talking about the safety of legalizing adult use cannabis. It was really helpful for my community to hear a few things, especially when we're talking about safety on the roads. So I just wanted to point out that there are a variety of ways that different substances affect the human body. And we know that alcohol is very, very unique in that way, in that we can use horizontal gaze nystagmus tests to, you know, track the movement of the eyes, and that's something that happens to the body. There's nothing you can do to control what happens. It's the alcohol that controls that movement in your eyes when you're at a certain level of impairment. And we don't have that for marijuana. We also don't have that for prescription medications that people abuse. We don't have that for Ambien. We don't have that for anything else. So, you know, what we do rely on, and I'm glad that Representative Witte brought this up, is DREs. And so I agree that we need to make sure we have solid drug recognition experts in the field, because they're already using visual and behavioral cues to interpret the levels of an impairment. And that is relatively accurate and effective. So I think we can lean on law enforcement to be drug recognition experts for that. And we also know that cannabis is a widely used medication now. And so we can't just say, if it's in your body, you're guilty of something. And to me, that gets into the territory of criminalizing being on some type of prescription drug, and that's a whole other issue. But I just wanted to bring attention to the testing for current levels of impairment. There are ways to do that, but it's not really effective to compare it to alcohol consumption, because it affects the body in such different ways and affects everybody differently. And the other thing I just wanted to bring up is that the legalization of cannabis will help a huge public safety issue that we have going on right now, which is fentanyl. And I hear a lot from community members about kids getting illegal weed off the streets and it's laced with fentanyl, and regulation fixes that. Regulation moves us entirely away from a market that has these substances that can kill people. So I just want to make sure we talked about those two pieces about cannabis and public safety. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I was struck at the different people I find myself agreeing with in this committee, and today I find myself in agreement, at least on a couple points, with the Marijuana Legalization Now party. That testifier brought up the fact that there'll be a black market. People, as Representative Holland said, you know, right now they're procuring from unregulated markets, and that's going to continue. We only have to look at Colorado, and nothing will change about that. They'll just lower their prices instead of getting a really ungodly amount of profit, they'll lower it down to an ungodly amount of profit. This won't change anything. This won't make the state safer. And this is not a bill about legalization. It's a bill about taxation. It's, you know, it really won't change anything. We have marijuana gummies right now that are legal. I was in a committee last week that some of you were on, and the testimony was that from one of the other representatives that, for all intents and purposes, marijuana is available to anyone right now. We're to me, it's the equivalent of the fireworks ban. We're fixing a problem that doesn't need to be fixed, and it's only going to make things worse. A couple years from now, people will be coming into committees talking about how legalized marijuana made a difference in her life, and I can't have that on my conscience. I will also be a no, and I'll stay a no. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the good discussion today. I did just want to speak about a couple things. You know, one is I think there's an interesting tension in some of the arguments that we hear from people who are opposed to this bill. You know, we hear on the one hand, well, this doesn't change anything because we already have these cannabis, these THC gummies. They're actually not cannabis gummies, but THC gummies that are widely available. They're everywhere, and why can't we just, you know, expunge and move on? And then on the other hand, we hear sometimes from the same people of all the calamities that will happen if cannabis is legalized. And I think that there's an obvious tension between those two positions. I think that what should be clear to everyone is that our current system is the one that is totally broken, the one that is the least desirable and is not working. It's not achieving the goals that we want it to. If it was going to, it would have done so many, many years ago. So we need to try something new. And I do think that this bill takes an important step towards trying to get rid of that illicit marketplace. That is something that is important to me. And very different states have had different levels of success. It is true that in some states it has not made the problem better, and in some cases has made the problem worse. And I am trying to find, learn from the mistakes made in those states. We're going to find entirely new mistakes to make here in Minnesota. That is my goal. I do not want to make the same mistakes that were made in other states. But I will just note that we do have some experience moving from an illicit marketplace into a legitimate marketplace with a controlled substance. You know, 100 years ago, there was an illicit marketplace for alcohol. Today, there is not. You know, it doesn't exist anymore. So I reject the defeatism of, like, we can't get rid of the illicit marketplace. We have been successful in doing that. The last thing I'll just say, you know, I appreciate very genuinely from both sides the comments about the process that I've undertaken, the approach, and I'm really committed to that and to taking on suggestions. I think we've taken 8 or 9 Republican amendments so far directly, and then way more where, like, the 3 today that I said, well, let's work on it, and I'll do something down the road in an author's amendment. So if you count all of those, we are well beyond 8 or 9. I'm really committed to that. But the reason why I wanted to mention all this is it's nice that you were directing those words to me, but I also want to take a moment because you get to see Ben Johnson every day in this committee, and what an unbelievable treasure Ben Johnson is. The work that he's doing for us all is just incredible. So I'll leave it with thanking Ben Johnson.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion and re-refer House File 100 as amended to the Committee on Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And I just want to thank all the members and all the staff, members of the public, for coming back. Really appreciate everybody's ability to come back today. And with that, we are adjourned.